Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Ian McEwan, whose latest novel is Solar. Earlier novels include Saturday, On Chesil Beach, Atonement, Enduring Love. Solar is a rarity in that it's a comic novel or a very funny novel. And before we went on the air, I mentioned that it seemed to me that you were having more fun than usual writing it.
It's true, partly in reaction to the subject matter, which is pretty hostile to the novel in general. It's impacted with morals, ethical questions, statistics, hard science. I decided that if I was going to get through this, it was going to need a lighter touch, really, to bring the reader through with this. And also, I decided that I was going to have a central character. It's very much a character-led novel. It was the character that emerged first. But given that I was going to heap him with a fair number of human faults and problems, I ought to lighten his load, or at least the reader's load, by making him something of a comic victim.
I'm not sure if victim is the right word for someone who creates his own messes quite like that.
Well, he's victim of his own mess, but also, you know, he has a near disaster in the Arctic, and he thinks he's pursued, probably mistakenly, by a polar bear, and various other things go wrong in his life, and he's branded as a neo-Nazi professor, and it doesn't always stem entirely from him.
Well, the character, Michael Beard, is a man who received a Nobel Prize in physics when he was very young, and this book occurs many years later when he's in his late 50s and then early 60s. His name, Michael Beard, I kept thinking about what a beard is, which is a person masquerading as the boyfriend or girlfriend of a gay person.
Yes, there was that. That's a very old-fashioned term. Edwardian, in fact. We have a very eminent literary critic in Britain called Mary Beard, and I've always thought, I like that name, I'm going to have that name. So it just, I didn't actually know Mary Beard personally, and I tend to go for names of people that I don't actually have an acquaintance with. But he doesn't have a beard.
You said in a long New Yorker profile, this was actually in terms of the character in Atonement, that the best way to deceive someone is first to deceive yourself. And it seems that that sentence encapsulates Michael Beard.
This is a perception very much derived from the great American psychologist Robert Trivers, an evolutionary psychologist, who suggested that if we want to deceive others, our faces give so much away that it would be much more effective if we could persuade ourselves first, and then we can carry out our deceptions wholeheartedly, carrying ourselves along with the process. This has meant a lot to me, this perception of Bob Trivers, and I've used it in various novels. Now that he's named it, I see it all around me and sometimes see it in myself. It takes some doing to notice that you're deceiving yourself, because what is the self that's going to see this process? But now and then I get my head pops above the surface, and I understand that my understanding of a situation is shaped by my wishing the situation to be such and such. So, yes, Michael Beard has this in bucket loads.
In bucket loads, to a point where he believes he invented things he didn't invent.
He half knows and then buries the thought that his idea for saving the world is actually borrowed, shall we say, kindly, from a gifted young student who's died in his presence.
As I was reading about his deception of himself, actually, I kept thinking of people like Rush Limbaugh in America, who, from all accounts, was actually political moderate or almost a liberal when he began his right-wing diatribes, and eventually came to believe, because I guess he had to believe, and it made me wonder about all of those people who scream their lies on television. The only way to get away with it is to somehow convince yourself that you're speaking the truth, even though you know you're not.
I'm sure they think they're telling the truth. It would be too hard and too exhausting and too much of a strain to be always smirking behind your hand. You know, you have to. This is the only way. And politics is not full of liars. It's full of self-deceivers. I mean, I don't just mean the commentary on politics, but politicians themselves. And we see it. You go to the theater, a brilliant actress or actor can deceive herself, himself, with unbelievable facility. They speak and emote their way into a role. So we have this little engine, I think, of self-persuasion, and it steams away very busily, and now that Trivers has blessed us with this perception, it's opened up for me many, many great moments in literature.
It seems in that sense that Michael Beard could just get on the stage and be an actor.
No, he would find that difficult. He is one of those men, one of those people, I should say, who is always on the edge of not quite reflecting on what he's doing. He does not have a clear meditative process. He's not a self-analytical kind of guy. He just lives day to day, hour to hour, breezing through. And he's led by his appetites, whether it's for food or sex. And then glory and money.
It seems that every so often this little thought does rise to the surface. This isn't my idea, you know. I know I should go to a doctor. I mean, all of these things occasionally do arise, but they disappear.
I mean, it's quite difficult to have an unreflective character. I suppose anyone who has a comic fat man at the center of their imaginary process lives in the very long and wide shadow of Shakespeare's Falstaff. Who, if we were to meet someone exactly like that, we'd find obnoxious, but somehow the distance makes us forgive him. He's a bit of a life force. Life force in literature equals an awful drunk in real life. We wouldn't tolerate him. The other wonderful contemporary example, I think, of a limited consciousness made to carry a heavy load is John Updike's Rabbit. He's a man of very limited education, not awfully clever, not particularly nice, and yet this rather narrow consciousness can bear the load of being a filter for Updike's reflections on 4 decades of American social change and an incredibly complicated private life, too. Michael Beard stands in the shadow, I think, of these 2 giant creations.
When you're writing a self-deceived character in what you call a free indirect style, which I guess is one step removed from first person, but it's very close to first person, he becomes a kind of unreliable narrator. How conscious is it for you, Ian McEwan, as a writer, trying to maintain that balance of self-deception without falling into the trap of writing a liar?
Just to come back to free and direct style, this is a third-person narrative that colors the world it describes with the perceptions of a particular personage. Probably its earliest and most brilliant expression was in Jane Austen. She more or less single-handedly offered us this beautiful process in which the reader is then in a very complex negotiation with what's on the page. And even children's books now, children take it for granted, this complicated matter by which the world is coloured by the character that's being described, but the character is not being described in the first person. So it's become a crucial tool, unconsciously used by all of us. But it does put us in strange positions. If I want to create an unsympathetic character like this, but one which I really want the reader to engage with, now and then I will take the liberty of offering him thoughts that are my own. He can reflect on, for example, the British press, or a little bit of the postmodern academy. And although I'm giving them to him, I think the reader begins to separate out in this elaborate game in the free and direct style just where we stand. So we have become, all of us, 6-year-olds too, quite sophisticated in our automatic use of the conventions. Just as in movies, you know, we don't go running behind the cinema screen to see where the action's coming from. With fiction, it becomes a seamless process.
Do you think that film, because film can't be first person unless you're talking about, you know, a film like Lady in the Lake, but most films can't be, that we've developed a perception that otherwise we might not have?
I think the film can never offer you that inside quality that fiction can. It can never give you the small print of consciousness. And that's why I think the novel has refused to lie down and die these last 50 years. It should have. Everybody was predicting it with the movies and then television. But somehow it's stayed on and maybe even strengthened its position in some ways, in that it goes on offering us probably our best tool for looking at the fine play between characters and their society. We don't quite get that with movies. You can't quite get the feeling of what it's like to be someone else. You're always watching from the outside. You can't get the flow of thought, that really nice interior sense.
Well, how do you feel then about say, the films of Enduring Love, where you were a producer, or Atonement?
You always lose something. I mean, there's no question. Everything is reduced to, in the first instance, to what people say and do. And that's what you've got, and where they stand, and the scenery behind them. A good actor can bring much to life, and a good cinematographer and director can heighten that in certain ways. It's a demolition job, really. I mean, a screenplay, and I've written a few myself, comes in at about 20,000 words. Most novels, 100,000. You've got to lose a lot. And it's not just the action and scenes that you lose. You lose that very inside quality. But you get something else. I mean, I guess the novel has always serviced the movie industry because it's offering them ready-made characters and plots. And that's what it boils down to.
What about working on something like an opera, like For You, where you wrote the libretto?
Well, that was a completely different process. I was writing that in tandem with writing my previous novel to Sola, On Chesil Beach. Every now and then I'd put the novel aside and do a scene. And I'd worked out with the composer a rough idea of the kind of thing we were doing, and that every scene would be about 10 or 12 minutes, and there were going to be 10 of them. And that's the kind of arithmetic I like. I mean, here is the structure. It's like knowing that your sonnet's going to have 14 lines, three quatrains and a couplet. I would write a 10 or 12 minute scene and send it off to Michael, and he would start sending it to music, which is a much bigger, longer process. And it's an opera about music in part, but it's also about artistic vanity. It's something like a Don Giovanni of a plot, in that its central character, who's not entirely unrelated to Michael Beard, oversteps himself and thinks that his art elevates him above the normal moral considerations of others, and comes unstuck, basically. It was fun to do. I mean, the only other collaborative stuff I've ever done is movies, which are much more messy, and money gets in the way. But here, in modern opera, because there is no money, everyone behaves well. No one's getting paid much. Everyone's in it for the love of it.
How do you think the work impacted either stylistically or content-wise or even maybe form-wise with the writing of Chesil Beach?
I think they were pretty well insulated from each other. But anyone reading the libretto For You would see, I think, certain elements. That there's the compulsive erotomania of Enduring Love, or there is the foolish composer of Amsterdam. There were sort of other elements, but not I think, on Chesil Beach, which is an entirely more private, self-contained story.
And yet the female character is a musician.
Yeah, there is that. She plays the violin. She leads her own quartet. Music has played a big part, and I'm passionate about music. I'm fairly Catholic in my taste. I'm writing the screenplay of On Chesil Beach for Sam Mendes at the moment. And I always said one should never write screenplays of your own stuff. I did The Innocent with John Schlesinger years back, and it wasn't a very happy process, and I got sick of the drafts. But this time round, I thought there was very little dialogue in On Chesil Beach until a crucial conversation at the end of the novel on the beach itself. And I thought, I'm not sure I want someone else to give voices to these characters. I think I want to keep them for myself. And it's a short novel. Maybe a novella will survive better in the process of being changed into a movie. I was thinking, the movie I enjoyed a couple of years ago, Brokeback Mountain. That was more or less scene for scene. It was all there from that short story. And I don't think that short story could have been longer than 6,000 or 7,000 words. So maybe that's the way to make this process work, is to let movies expand on a piece of fiction rather than condense a piece of fiction. And maybe short stories and novellas are the real source, the best source.
Well, what I've heard is that, say, a 90-page short story is pretty much perfect for a film.
I think that would be right. Think of Death in Venice. Worked beautifully. You didn't come away thinking there was something missing. In fact, what you ended up with is something is added, because von Aschenbach becomes a sort of Mahler-like figure.
John Huston did that several times, too.
Oh, The Dead.
Yeah.
The best literary translation that ever was made.
Wise Blood.
Yeah, Wise Blood. Sends a little shiver down my back. They gave such pleasure to me. Those are the real honorable conversions, I think. Most literature does suffer a lot in the process.
You're listening to an interview with Ian McEwan, who's latest novel is Solar. Let's talk a little about some of the content in Solar. I understand from that New Yorker article that it began with a sentence of a character who you didn't know at the time was Michael Beard looking down on London, and that's actually the opening of the second part of the book, coming back from Berlin and seeing something below. But before that, you must have had an idea. You've said in talking about Saturday, and you've moved on, that the present always has new neuroses, and the current neurosis in that sense would be climate change.
Yeah. Every now and then, I think it's good to get your hands really dirty and engage head on with the present. And the present is always contentious. Everyone has their own version of it. You always find, if you write a novel, not only set in the present, but about the present, that you'll take a lot more flack than if you lifted it safely 50 years back or 200 years forward or even 500 years back. It's contested ground. We all feel we own the present, and rightly. I mean, we all have a stake in this. It's more exciting somehow to do this. I couldn't do it every time. I think it would just drive me nuts. It would exhaust me. And I'm pretty sure the next thing I do will float free somewhat of where we stand.
So you decided to take on climate change, and yet you put the words about climate change in the voice of this rather nasty man, which I guess has convinced some people that perhaps you're a climate change skeptic, which you're not.
No, I'm not. I'm quite just the opposite of a skeptic. Although, no, let me put that again. I'm just the opposite of a denier. I think actually we need skeptics, and we need skepticism, and good science needs thorough scrutiny and should always take that on board. And in fact, there's some very good individuals out there running the math and demanding thorough explanations. I think that's all fine. It's at the two ends of the debate, the denialists at one end and the catastrophists at the other, who actually join hands in paralyzing us. If we think we're all going to die next week, then we might as well party this week, and you end up in the same position as the deniers would have us be in. I've immersed myself for 3 years in the subject. I've read hundreds of papers on it, and I think that something is happening and we're causing it. What's in contention is the speed of this. And it's probably the case that the combined systems of the Earth's climate and the biosphere together make an even more complex structure than even the human brain itself. So we can expect some mistakes, and science is not free of human error and mess and jealousy and egos and strivings and so on. But I didn't want to use the novel as a platform to preach about climate science. I want to write a novel about human nature, confronted with something quite unique, something that requires us to think of doing favors to people we'll never meet, like our great-grandchildren, to think in the long term, which we're not generally programmed to do. And so I decided that if I was going to write about human nature, I would really draw on a lot of our faults that we all have in common and garnish it with a great deal of cleverness, because the one thing Michael Beard is certainly is he's a very clever man. I think he embodies the spirit of Copenhagen. Cleverness in the form of rationality, in the form of science, gathered 192 nations in one town and got ambushed by another side of human nature. Short-term national self-interest, cabals, all kinds of follies and pomposities, and the whole thing ended in disgrace. That's why I have Michael Beard invited to Copenhagen at the end of the novel to go and address foreign ministers, and that's why I say he's the perfect man for the place.
There's also the idea, as you say, that the greatest gift we could give to future generations, which will repay nothing for us, would be saving the planet, and you give that role to a man who can't think 5 minutes into the future.
Well, he can think that it would be very nice if his name could go down in history as the guy who found the technology, artificial photosynthesis, that would split water, that would give us free hydrogen, or almost free hydrogen, so that we could power civilization for the rest of all time. We're on the edge, if this is going to happen, of a possible industrial revolution. All kinds of opportunities are going to roll the way of all kinds of unsavory people. And it's not only going to be good people who save the planet, there'll be some bad ones too. If there are going to be giant subsidies, it's already happening in Europe. Already there have been some amazing scams, you know, wind farms that don't exist, drawing down from the head of the EU, from Brussels, giant subsidies, I mean, hundreds of millions of euros. Just as in the last Industrial Revolution, there were all kinds of crooks and sharks and also some very clever people making things happen, not very nice people. So with this one, we cannot expect this is all going to be run by angels.
Well, neither was the computer revolution, and there were certainly enough thieves there as well.
Yeah, and maybe you could say, taking the long view, that we were all the beneficiaries of these various revolutions. Still, it will be messy and aggressive and greedy and foolish, and lots of backtracking will happen and loads of mistakes. But I think also we will somehow fumble our way through. I feel that we've got just enough rationality to trump our stupidity, and we will, with some disasters along the way and catastrophes, we will probably make it through because self-interest compels us to.
And the idea of photosynthesis as the model for the solution, if you want to call it that, how did you stumble on that? Or is that becoming a scientific consensus?
No, it is one potential technology among many. I don't think there is one single solution. I think we've got to work on many fronts. But it is happening in various labs in California, at MIT, Imperial College London, very good group in Australia. Chinese are doing things, all working a way to find the nanotechnology that could recreate for us something of that first phase of photosynthesis when light, not using electricity, but using light to split water. But you've got to do it with elements that are cheap. It's no good, you know, having some trace element that you're going to pay millions of dollars to mine somewhere from, you know, some remote region.
Unobtainium.
Unobtainium, yeah. Well, yeah, just think of lithium and the race for that now in Bolivia. So it's got to be something reasonably accessible. If we crack it, then perhaps in 20 or 30 years' time, there really will be a scaled-up industrial model in the New Mexican desert, splitting water and running a fuel cell generator and powering a small township.
Ian McEwan, you made mention before of bringing yourself into the book, and in that great New Yorker article, there's also mention of the story of the potato chips and how Beard thought someone had stolen his chips when he hadn't, and you were reminded there that it was actually in Douglas Adams after a reading, and you put that in the book.
Yeah, I tell the story of Michael Beard on a train. He has some potato chips in front of him. He's bought some in the airport. He starts to eat them. A fellow passenger on the other side, facing him across the seat, starts eating them too. They get locked into a kind of competition about this. Beard gets off the train, puts his hand in his pocket, and finds that actually he was the one who was stealing the other man's chips, not the other way around, because his are still in his pocket. I read this story at the Hay Festival in England, and someone stood up and said, "You pinched that from Douglas Adams." I already knew that the story was a complete urban legend. It goes the rounds in much the way a dirty joke does. And so I thought, well, let's unwrap this for the reader. So I decided to introduce a character of a professor of urban legends who comes and accuses Beard of just making the whole thing up because he knows very well that it's an archetypal story, like, you know, crocodiles in the New York sewers, or, you know, there are thousands of them out there. And just as the internet has generated and helped spread a lot of these stories, it has also gathered together some incredibly good skeptical websites where you can look and trace the movement through time of these stories. And I thought, well, it's a very interesting reflection on plots, you know, and how they shape our lives and the anecdotes we tell each other and the half-truths by which, to give you an example, when I read that story about the crisps, the chips, in the signing queue afterwards, there was at least half a dozen people, maybe eight or nine, who said, something like that has happened to me, or to my friend, or to my wife, or my husband. Everyone claims it. And who knows, perhaps, you know, it really does happen. It's called in urban legend studies the unwitting thief. And it has many variants. You know, it can be a guy, flat tire on the side of the road, someone comes along to help him. The guy with the flat tire then attacks the guy who's helping because he thinks he's stolen his wallet, gets home, and the wallet's on the bed. They always have these common elements that a stranger is wrongly accused by you and your guilt is all the greater. That fascinates me, so that's why I drew it all in. And I was prompted by this questioner. Douglas Adams claimed, you know, it happened to him on a train. I think it's very unlikely. He put it in his novel about the time the story spread to Britain from the United States. And it had been in the States since the end of the 19th century.
You also have a segment poking fun at academia because Beard makes the comment that most physicists are male. And he's attacked. Before we went on there, you were talking about a joke made by Martin Amis, that a friend of yours, that was picked up as if it was a straight comment.
Well, a straight comment involving a program for genocide, yeah. The British press are very, very rackety and intrusive and partisan and hysterical. And I think maybe we're watching the death agonies of an industry because, you know, circulations are shrinking and papers are ferociously competitive with each other. Very strange compared to a fair amount of experience of the press in different countries. And since I've been at the center of one or two press storms, and certainly friends of mine have, I thought, I'll do a press storm, just to unwrap something else. And also, I mean, the parallel interest for me was in science, to confront a scientist with the postmodern world of science studies. In this academic world, which many people will not be familiar with, there's a great reluctance to feel that the world is simply out there waiting to be described. You know, it is utterly created by ideology, by power relations. And so I have a science studies person say that genes don't actually exist. They're socially intexted, and they are the consequence of concentrations of power and resources. I tried this out on my son, because I read this in a science studies textbook. My son is a geneticist in Cambridge. And he looked so blankly at me when I suggested to him that the genes that he was daily splicing didn't exist. That's when I thought, I've got to use this in the novel too. The mutual incomprehension was what gave me such pleasure.
Your son was supposed to write an essay on enduring love, asked you questions about it, and the teacher gave him a D.
Yeah. Actually, it happened to Tom Stoppard too. He helped his one of his children through an exam process, and she got an E. You need to be able to remember, enduring love, there is a stalker figure who is filled with religious passion. And the central character is married to a woman who's a Keats scholar. And she doubts the process by which Joe Rose is being stalked. She thinks he's making it all up. And the novel is really about how she is wrong, that just because she's a good person doesn't mean she's right. But the woman who was teaching my son, who was quite a sort of right-on feminist type, felt that actually the woman was the moral authority of the book. Well, I disagreed. I still think, though, that one shouldn't mark term papers on an ideological basis. In other words, my son wrote a perfectly fluent paper. She might have disagreed with his conclusions, but I don't think she should have marked him down. I never got involved. I didn't go and challenge her about this. Perhaps I should have. But it does suggest the powerful ways in which our mindsets can alter the reality of a book for us.
I keep thinking of that scene in Annie Hall where a person on a line starts babbling about McLuhan. Yeah,
well, yeah, and he appears.
Right.
He says, your friend has completely misunderstood my work.
But the response here, of course, is that the teacher would turn to McLuhan and say, no, you're wrong.
You're wrong. Yes, because postmodernism has displaced the author. The author is not now the authority on the work. Absolutely. I wouldn't have a chance in that line, that movie theater line.
Ian McEwan, how did On Chesil Beach come about?
It came about like this. In between novels, I keep a large green notebook in which I liberate myself from the task of writing novels by writing the imaginary beginnings of novels that I know I never complete. And that confers on me a kind of freedom to doodle. They're like sketches of things that don't have to be completed. It's like a drawing of a hand rather than a whole body. And it was in that state of mind that I wrote the opening sentence of On Chesil Beach, which more or less stands as it is, with a few changes. And that opening sentence introduced immediately two characters in a confined and specific situation.
They were young, educated, and both virgins on this, their wedding night, and they lived in a time when a conversation about sexual difficulties was plainly impossible.
And I thought, in there is a whole short novel. I only have to unwrap who they are, where they are, and all the things that are not going to get said, and where it will end. Writing of the novel was simply the slow unfolding of everything that seemed to be implied in this easily written sentence.
Was the process in writing it any different than the process in writing a longer book like Saturday or Solar or Atonement?
Yes, because I knew this was going to be about 40,000 words. A novella does have a very different feel structurally, and the demands are different. You can afford, for example, a really confined set. It's almost like a squash court. It's a place with limits, rules, spaces that are already defined for you. The unwrapping of that first sentence was quite a slow process. I mean, I didn't know who they were for a long time. It took me a good while to get the voice to of the telling. And at some point, and maybe 2 or 3 months after writing that sentence, I wrote myself a little message which went something like, it was just a list of all the qualities that the narrative had to have, and it was something like wry, forgiving, omniscient, generous. It went on like that. And I thought, yes, that's the kind of tone I want. So the narrator of this, who's not a character, but is almost a character, had to be discovered too, the tone in which their tale was going to be told. And once I got that, and that was many, many attempts at the first 3,000 or 4,000 words, then the thing unfolded relatively easily. I mean, in time, it probably took another, after that initial 5 or 6 months, took another 6 months to write.
Did you know these characters in ways that don't appear in the book?
I felt as if I was discovering them. I mean, I sort of knew. I knew this girl, and yet I don't have a memory of such a girl. Sweet-natured, honest, nervous, lovely, constrained figure. And the boy, quick to fistfights, sort of bit of a country hick quality about him, big-knuckled, clumsy, not very reflective, but also a sweet-natured type at heart. And again, I wanted to explore how two people in love, and not bad people at all, could misunderstand each other in ways that caused them to separate forever at the end of this story.
Did you know that would be the ending of the story when you began it?
Yeah. I don't know when I knew it, but I knew it pretty soon after writing that first sentence. One of the interesting problems posed by making this into a movie is the role of her father, because there is a hint of sexual abuse from him on the yacht. And how to do this has become, for me, one of the most interesting problems to untangle, because, again, a movie is literal. If you're on a yacht, you're on a yacht. You rent a yacht, you've got to find out what happens there. But I want it to be so glancing. I don't want this to be over-determined, which is why it's so glancing in the novel, and some people see it and others don't. I want the movie to be the same.
Someone asked me, what happened to her?
When I was a student, we all had to read a very famous essay on Shakespeare called How Many Children Had Lady Macbeth? It was by Professor L.C. Knights. It was very important for me to make sure that I did not summarize both lives right to the end. One of them has to disappear from the narrative. She has to go so that you could stay with him and feel the loss. I could have stayed with her and let him go, but actually she's the one who walks away. She's the one who gives us the pathos of the retreating form in the dusk down the long strand of the beach. And so I just needed him in the frame summarize the life in 3 or 4 pages, the speed with which you can one point be 22 and suddenly be 65, and realizing despite all the dope you smoked and rock concerts you organized and the record shops that you ran and the childless life that you had, you never wrote the history books you said you would, and you never actually, once the 60s revolution got going, ever met anyone remotely as serious as the girl that you failed to stay married to. And if only you'd taken your time, you didn't have to have all-out fantastic sex of the night of your marriage, you could have just waited. So it's that point of regret in him that I wanted to stay with.
And he could have, any time in those next 3 or 4 or 5 years, he could have gone back to her.
Of course he could. But actually what happens, you know, that's 1962, 3, then suddenly he's in Camden Town, London, and, you know, suddenly it's not so difficult to meet girls and hang out with them. And, you know, his life goes shooting off in this direction of endless pleasure. He half forgets about her. It was only towards the end of his own life that he begins to regret exactly what he lost.
Ian McEwan, there seems to be a pull inside your books, a subtext, science at the one hand and a certain amount of faith at the other, with science finally winning over in a way. Given that you're friends with Martin Amis, given that you're friends with Christopher Hitchens, and given that you dealt with some of the idiocies of the New Age, I'm wondering how much that has influenced how you view the world.
I've taken a lot from science. For me, it's a source of aesthetic pleasure as much as anything else. I think if one were in that frame of mind when you want to celebrate the human project and all that's achieved in the last few thousand years, it's not only the Bach partitas and the Grateful Dead and the Sistine Chapel, it's actually the great machinery that we've invented of scientific investigation that can self-correct all the time, that's adversarial, that constantly shifts its position in relation to new data, something that religion finds very hard to do. Religions get sort of locked in to a revealed moment. I feel there's more liberty, more excitement, more awe, more inspiration in the idea of unfolding, unwrapping the truth about the physical world than I'd ever find in even a remarkable book like Genesis.
And what do you think of Dancing Woolly Masters today?
I remember we were all very caught with the sort of magic of quantum mechanics and thinking that maybe there's a bridge between that and philosophy. And actually, the more I've come to understand about quantum mechanics, the more I realize that it is its own thing, and it's very hard to draw any ethical conclusions from it. I'm reading a novel, actually, at the moment, which is trying to do just that, and I really applaud the effort. It's so difficult. Quantum mechanics doesn't describe the world so much as describe our knowledge about the world. You know, it really is the world at one remove. I think that in my passionately idealistic sense of science in the 70s, especially, I really thought we could draw moral conclusions from quantum mechanics, and now I think we can't.
What's the book?
It's called The Book of Opposites. It's not yet published, and I'm going to get the writer's name wrong. David Morley. I'm about a third of the way through, but I'm really impressed by his wish to kind of forge the very thing that I certainly failed to do in all those years ago.
Ian McEwan, you said you're working on Chesil Beach. Is there any interest in solar?
Well, the film rights are sold, but not yet entered into any discussions as to how to do this. I mean, one thought I had is that most of my novels could only really be set in Britain or Venice or wherever. This one could probably be anywhere. I mean, Michael Beard could be an American. I mean, I have met people who think that even Americans like junk food.
And in terms of writing more librettos, operas, plays?
Well, there is going to be an opera of Atonement, same composer, but I've decided not to do the libretto. And a very dear friend of mine, the poet Craig Raine, here I am doing on Chesil Beach. I think if I started to make an opera out of that, out of that novel, Atonement, I'd just be trapped in an endless recycling process. And I know recycling is very good, but only up to a point.
The late Donald Westlake, who was a wonderful screenplay writer, refused to tackle his own work. He said it's easier and better to tackle other people's.
It is better to mess up other people's novels than mess up your own, I think. But I've been saying this for years, but I just thought, it's a short novel, and I'll be finishing Solar soon, and I'd want something to do between novels. And Sam Mendes wants to direct it, if I would write it. And I admire his stuff. And so, I said yes. And I haven't regretted it so far. I mean, I'm two-thirds of the way through, and I'm having fun.
Have you started work on the next novel?
No, it's too soon. I have to let this one die on me, and it will. I'll talk it out of myself. Here I am now, helping the process. and then I'll need a gap. I need to do a lot of reading and talking and thinking and traveling and becoming a slightly different person. And I need to open a new green notebook and start irresponsibly describing the openings or middles or endings of novels I'll never write.
When you're writing and living with a character like Michael Beard, a fairly atrocious character, how do you kind of keep yourself separate, or do you just kind of like look at the page and laugh and close the book?
I hope that the reader will come not to quite like Michael Beard, but to sort of enjoy his scurrilous company. He's a scoundrel. He's not evil, but he is a scoundrel. And he's got some redeeming qualities. Don't ask me to name, the list is not long, but I think I would hope his cleverness and deviousness added up to at least an object of fascination.
Well, I love his inability to function in the Arctic, which you were there, so.
Yes, I mean, functioning in the Arctic's not easy, especially in minus 45. Again, there's another matter when Michael Beard becomes something of a comic victim.
And I understand that the story of the boot room is a true story.
Yes, we were in the Arctic, a group of artists and scientists on a ship frozen into a fjord, and I noticed the disparity between the chaos of this changing room where we had to keep all our snowmobile suits and helmets and so on, and our passionate desire to set the world to rights, a world many trillion times larger than the boot room. And it was really that gave me a sense that maybe perhaps there was a comedy to be unfolded in this drama of human nature in confronting this particular problem of climate change.
One final question. John Banville has written a lot of very serious books, and then he decided on a lark under a different name to write a series of detective novels to see if he could do it, and he actually did it better than most people. Do you ever get a wish to just kind of walk away from the Ian McEwan idea and just write something different?
Well, write a genre novel.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did it once and enjoyed it. I wrote a spy novel called The Innocent, set in Berlin in the mid-50s, the height of the Cold War, Anglo-American project to dig a secret tunnel into the Soviet sector of Berlin. And the whole thing was betrayed by a real existing English spy, George Blake. And now and then I do think of science fiction and detective fictions as a way of making a sort of knight's move, as it were, out of literary fiction. So that is something I toy with.
You've been listening to an interview with Ian McEwan, whose latest novel is Solar. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.